Chapter 7, Karma and Rebirth. Old age, sickness and death were the spurs to Siddhartha Gautama's quest, and what he realized when he became the Buddha somehow put an end to these things. It was not just that he came to terms with death. It was not even that he looked forward to death. He realized something, not intellectually but by way of direct perception, that transformed him into a new species of being to whom birth and death simply did not apply. As we have seen in the previous chapter, the Buddha doubted at first the possibility of communicating this alchemical insight, what he called the truth of Pratitya-samutpada, to anyone else. But communicate it he did, deep and subtle as it was. And though his seminal formulation of Pratitya-samutpada engendered over the years a vast and rich array of teachings, it remains the basis, the very foundation, of all of them. In philosophical terms, at least, it is the realization of this truth of universal conditionality which constitutes the essence of the Buddha's enlightenment. Hence we describe it as the fundamental principle of Buddhism. It originally took the form in his mind of a laconic, even bleak statement. This is conditioned by that. All that happens is by way of a cause. However, the most renowned version of this principle derives, perhaps significantly, from an occasion when it was being communicated, and with dramatic success. In this particular instance, it was in fact communicated not by the Buddha himself, but by one of his disciples, and it was imparted to a seeker after the truth who was to become the Buddha's chief disciple. It was a few months after the Buddha's enlightenment. A young Brahmin from Bihar, called Shariputra, had gone forth from home, just as the Buddha had, along with his childhood friend Maudgalyayana. He was now on his own, because the two of them had agreed that they would go off in different directions, and that whichever of them found an enlightened teacher first would tell the other, thus doubling their chances, so to speak. In the course of his travels, Shariputra happened to meet one of the Buddha's first five disciples, called Ashvajit, who had by this time become enlightened himself and gone forth to teach the Dharma. Very much impressed by the appearance of this wandering monk, who radiated tranquility and happiness, Shariputra approached him, greeted him, and asked, "Who is your teacher?" This might seem to us a rather direct way of addressing a total stranger. In England, we generally open a conversation with a remark like, "Nice weather we're having," or "Looks like it's beginning to clear up a bit now." But in India, they tend to come straight to the point. So Shariputra asked the question that people in India still ask each other when they meet in this way, and Ashvajit answered, "My teacher is Shakyamuni the sage, the wise one of the Shakya tribe, the Buddha." Shariputra then put to Ashvajit the second standard question. Standard, but in this case anyway, also momentous. "What does he teach?" Ashvajit said, "Frankly, I'm a beginner. I really don't know much about the Dharma, but I can tell you in brief what it's about." And what he then said has since become famous throughout the Buddhist world in the form of a short Pali verse of just two lines. He said, or pronounced, or perhaps even declaimed, "Of all those things that proceed from a cause, the Tathagata has explained the cause and also its cessation. This is the teaching of the great Shramana." It seems that this stanza made a shattering and at the same time liberating impression on the mind of Shariputra. he had an instantaneous glimpse of the truth which it embodied. Transcendental insight arose in him, and he became a stream entrant on the spot. Obviously, the ground had been so well prepared that this most compressed exposition of the Dharma was enough to tell him his quest was at an end. He could go to his friend, Maudgalyayana, and tell him with confidence that he had found the Buddha. You will find this verse of Ashvajit's recorded, honoured and worshipped all over the Eastern Buddhist world. In Tibet, China, Japan, Thailand, Sri Lanka, it is found carved on stone monuments and clay tablets, printed on strips of paper to be stuffed inside images, and inscribed on plates of silver or gold. It is, we may say, the credo of Buddhism. If it seems rather dry and abstract, academic, uninspiring even, it certainly did not seem so to Shariputra. And when you really think about the principle of Praticca Samuppada, in whatever form it is put, when you meditate on it, when you really follow through its implications, you begin to understand the extraordinary impact it has had on the world. Whatever comes into existence, on whatever level, does so in dependence on conditions, and in the absence of those conditions, ceases to exist. This is all it says. But if anything is Buddhism, this is Buddhism. What it is saying is that from the viewpoint of the enlightened mind, the outstanding feature of all phenomena, whether physical or psychical, is that they are conditioned. The unceasing flux of things, both material events and states of mind, is a process of interdependent stages, each of which comes about through the presence of conditions, and, in its turn, conditions the stages succeeding it. Rainfall, sunshine, and the nourishing earth are the conditions from which arises the oak tree, whose fallen leaves rot and form the rich humus from which the bluebell grows. A jealous attachment will have consequences which may lead to murder. Nothing phenomenal is spontaneously produced without preceding conditions, or itself fails to have consequences. And it is the process of becoming aware of this law of conditionality that gradually liberates us from all conditions, leading to the freely functioning, spontaneous creativity of enlightenment. If we are reasonably clear about what it was that constituted the Buddha's realization, we can move on to look at how it actually dealt with the questions which Siddhartha originally set out to answer. What about old age, sickness and death? Where do the immutable facts of our physical decay fit into the whole process of conditionality? Does this unceasing flux of things continue beyond death, or is death the end? These questions, of course, are not abstract for us or theoretical. The mystery of death which so troubled primitive humanity is still a mystery. Even these days, when we apparently know so much, you only need to give a talk called The Tibetan Book of the Dead, or What Happens After Death, or Where You Go When You Die, to draw record crowds. And there is always a healthy market for books about death and dying. We may think things have changed immeasurably since primitive times, but they haven't changed much when it comes to our understanding of death. Indeed, if anything, the problem of death has become more pressing. We're not, however, talking here about one single problem of death common to everyone. the way we feel about death, and the way we come to terms, or not, with death, is not exactly the same as the way other people feel about it. And people's feelings and ideas about death have changed over time, over the centuries as well. Putting the problem of death into some kind of historical perspective, we may say that it all really began when mankind first started growing crops in the age of the great river valley civilizations. This was perhaps 10 or 15,000 years ago. At that time, the world began to take on an aspect that was less hostile and mysterious, but people were still in the dark about the greatest of all mysteries, death. The mystery, in fact, grew deeper and darker, and it seemed to weigh on people's minds more oppressively than ever before. There was a reason for this. People no longer wandered about in roving bands. They lived in villages and towns, even in great cities. Civilization as we know it, so to speak, had begun. Life had become more secure and comfortable, and people enjoyed it more. And having begun to enjoy it, they wanted to go on enjoying it. They didn't want to leave their wives or husbands, their children, their houses, and their neatly cultivated fields, their singing and their dancing, their games of chance and their religious rites. But one day they would have to, and they knew it. The thought of death threw a shadow over the sunlight of their lives. What was life for if it had to end so soon? You had just a few short years of youth, pleasure and prosperity, and after that, just a blank, a void, with nothing apparently surviving. Perhaps some ghostly wraith twittering in the darkness, but nothing more. What could you do about it? It seemed that you could do nothing at all. Most people just tried to forget about it and enjoy life as much as possible while they could. Eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we die, expressed the substance of their philosophy. A few, who were made of sterner stuff, immersed themselves in action. They performed heroic deeds, went about slaying monsters, fighting battles, conquering kingdoms. They tried to make a name for themselves, so that even though they might perish, probably sooner rather than later, their names would live on after them, so they hoped forever. But even these heroes, in their more reflective moments, saw that this was all a bit pointless. Human life, it seemed, was not just a mystery but a tragedy. This mood is reflected in the traditions and tales of ancient cultures, which were eventually written down to become the earliest examples of our literature. We find it in the Babylonian Epic of Gilgamesh from around 3000 BCE, and in Homer's account of the fall of Troy, the Iliad, composed over 2000 years later. It is there in the Anglo-Saxon epic poem Beowulf, dating from the 8th century, and it is perhaps even more powerfully and bitterly expressed in the Bible, in the book of Ecclesiastes, the book of the preacher. The vanity of human ambition in the face of death, the great leveller, is a favourite theme in ancient literature, and has inspired the same sort of thing in more recent times. The boast of heraldry, the pomp of power, and all that beauty, all that wealth e'er gave, awaits alike the inevitable hour. The paths of glory lead but to the grave. But this was not the whole story. It was only half the story, the western half. Further east, people had started to take a different attitude, and had in fact arrived at some sort of solution to the mystery of death, which of course also meant some sort of solution to the mystery of life. What they perceived was that death was not the end. human beings did not just vanish. After a time, they came back in a new body, in accordance with the nature of the deeds they had performed in their previous life. This perception made its first appearance in India at about the time of Homer, about 800 BCE, and from India thereafter spread widely. The first clear reference to it is found in the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad, in which the idea is represented as a highly esoteric teaching, to be communicated only to the chosen few. But as the idea spread, it became known in a more organized, systematized form as the teaching of karma and rebirth. When people in the West go flocking along to a lecture on karma and rebirth, or the Tibetan Book of the Dead, what they really want to know is, what is going to happen to me when I die? Is death the end, the absolute full stop, or not? The fact is, if we could be assured that death was not the end, there would be no problem at all. If people knew with absolute certainty that they weren't going to just disappear when they died, they would be a lot less inclined to go and hear a lecture on karma and rebirth, or to snap up the latest commentary on the Tibetan Book of the Dead. For us, death is the problem. But in the East, especially the Hindu and Buddhist East, it is rather different. People are not so bothered about death there. For them, death is natural and inevitable, and so is rebirth. You die and you are reborn. You die again and you are reborn again. That's just the way it is. It's not a matter for speculation at all. In the East, it is not death that is the problem. The problem is how to escape from the whole process of birth and death. How can you reach a state in which you will no longer be subject to birth and death? The problem is dying and being born time and time again through endless ages. So the question is carried a stage further. What for the West is a solution of the problem is for the East a problem in itself, requiring a further solution. And this is where the Buddha's discovery of the universal principle of conditionality comes in. When, in the course of the enlightenment experience, the Buddha surveyed the whole vast range of conditioned existence, he saw that everything, from the lowest to the highest, was subject to the universal law of conditionality. And he also saw that this universal law operates, as we've already seen from the point of view of our evolutionary model, in two distinct modes, a cyclical mode and a spiral mode. In the cyclical mode, there is action and reaction between opposites. We experience pleasure and pain, vice and virtue, birth and death. And usually what happens is that we swing back and forth between them. Life is followed by death, which is in turn followed by new life. Pain is followed by pleasure, which is again followed by pain. At all levels of life, physical, biological, psychological, sociological, historical, this same cyclical process can be found to be operating. Empires rise only to fall. Growth must be succeeded by decay. Health, wealth, fame and status have loss, old age, sickness, death and oblivion as their inevitable outcome. In the spiral mode of conditionality, on the other hand, there is the possibility of real and permanent growth. Each factor in this process, rather than reversing the effect of the previous one, increases its effect. For example, instead of an oscillation between pleasure and pain, you go from pleasure to happiness, then from happiness to joy, from joy to rapture, from rapture to bliss, and so on indefinitely. And this spiral mode can be applied to life and death just as much as to anything else. The Buddha saw that as well as being subject to the endless round of birth and death, it was possible for human beings to enter the spiral path of spiritual development, which was the way to the door of the deathless, the way beyond the opposites of life and death. When applied to the process of life and death, the principle of conditionality gave rise to one of the most famous and important and frequently misunderstood Buddhist teachings, karma and rebirth. And this is the first thing to understand about karma, that this is all it is. It is just an application of the principle of conditionality. Nothing mysterious, nothing odd, nothing strange, nothing occult. Karma, in the most general terms, represents the law of conditionality at work on a certain plane of existence. This has to be emphasized because one major source of confusion seems to be the idea that karma is the Buddhist teaching of cause and effect, and that it is universal, which is not the case. The universal principle is conditionality, and karma is only one of the ways in which conditionality operates. This point may be clarified by referring to a Buddhist teaching which actually dates from considerably later than the Buddha's own lifetime. It comes, in fact, from the analytical and systematizing philosophical tradition of the Abhidharma, and it is the teaching of what is called the five niyamas. These five niyamas are a very useful formulation because, as is the way with the Abhidharma, they draw together strands which are otherwise rather loose and disconnected, as we find them in the original suttas. The word niyama is a term common to Pali and Sanskrit, meaning a natural law, a cosmic order. According to this teaching, there are five of them, showing the law of cause and effect at work on five different levels. The first three are straightforward enough, as they can be related to Western sciences. Firstly, there's the Utu Niyama. Utu means non-living matter. Nowadays, people are beginning to doubt whether there is any such thing as non-living matter, but let's call it that for the time being. In other words, this is the physical, inorganic order of existence. Utu Niyama is therefore the law of cause and effect as operative on the level of inorganic matter. It very roughly embraces the laws of physics and chemistry and associated disciplines. The second Niyama is Bija Niyama. Bija means seed, so Bija Niyama deals with the world of living matter, the physical organic order whose laws constitute the science of biology. Then there is Chitta Niyama. Chitta is mind, so Chitta Niyama is conditionality as operative in the world of mind. The existence of this third Niyama, therefore, implies that mental activity and development are not haphazard, but governed by laws. And it is important that we understand what this means. We are used to the idea of laws operating on the level of physics, chemistry, and biology, but we are not so used to the idea that similar laws might govern mental events. We are more inclined in the West to the view that mental events just happen without any particular causation. To some extent, and in some quarters, the influence of Freud has begun to shift this assumption. But the idea that mental phenomena arise in dependence on conditions is not one that has yet penetrated deeply into popular thinking. It is there in Buddhism, however, in this teaching of Chitta Niyama, the law of cause and effect as operative in the world of mind. And we may say that it is a concept which corresponds to the modern science of psychology. Fourthly, karma niyama. Karma, Pali, is of course more popularly known in its Sanskrit form karma, and it means action, but in the sense of deliberately willed action. So it is traditionally and paradoxically said that sometimes karma is equivalent to chetana, volitional consciousness. That is, that action equals volition. For as soon as volition arises, one does the action, whether by body, speech or mind. Karma niyama, therefore, pertains to the world of ethical responsibility. It is the principle of conditionality operative on the moral plane. It is perhaps difficult for those of us with a background of Western thought on morality to understand how this works. In ordinary social life, if you commit a crime, you are arrested and brought before the judge or magistrate, tried and convicted, sentenced and sent to jail or fined. Committing the crime and being punished are quite separate events, and there is someone or something, society, the police, the judge, the law, who punishes you. Our tendency is to apply this legal model when it comes to morality as a whole. We think of sin and the punishment of sin, virtue and the reward of virtue. And traditionally, we have tended to think in terms of a judge too, somebody who sees what you do and punishes or rewards you accordingly, the judge being, of course, God. People imagine God as holding a sort of tremendous quarter sessions, with everybody hauled up in front of him and the angels and demons standing around like police witnesses. It is still official Christian doctrine that when you die, you face your judge. And this is a terrible thought for the Orthodox Christian, that you are going to be put in the dock before the transcendental beak and then bundled off wherever he sends you. The dramatic possibilities inherent in the doctrine has made for some terrific literature, music, drama and art. Michelangelo's tremendous painting of the Last Judgment in the Sistine Chapel is just one notable example. But it also makes for rather poor philosophy and a mode of thinking from which we are still suffering a ghastly hangover. The Buddhist point of view is totally different, and one that may seem distinctly odd to us with our approach to ethics, almost whether we like it or not, underpinned by Christian theology. In Buddhism, there is a law, but no lawgiver, and no one who administers the law. I have heard Christian missionaries arguing with Buddhists and insisting that if you believe in a law, there must be a lawgiver. But of course, this is quite specious. After all, there is a law of gravity, but there isn't a god of gravity pushing and pulling things. The law of gravity is just a generalized description of what happens when objects fall. In the same way, we don't have a god of heredity or a god of sexual selection. These things just happen. They work themselves. It is much the same on the moral plane according to Buddhism. The law administers itself, so to speak. Good karma naturally results in happiness, and bad karma naturally results in misery. There is no need for anybody else to come along, look at what you've done, and then fit the punishment or the reward to the deed. It happens of its own accord. Good and bad are built into the structure of the universe. This might sound dreadfully anthropomorphic, and we are putting it rather crudely here, but what it really means is that from the Buddhist point of view, the universe is an ethical universe. Putting it more precisely, the universe functions according to conditionality, and this operates at the karmic level in a way which we could describe as ethical, in that it conserves ethical values. This is karma niyama. The fifth and last niyama is dharma niyama. Dharma, Dharma in Sanskrit, which is a word with a number of different possible applications, here means simply spiritual or transcendental, as opposed to mundane. So the principle of conditionality operates on this level too. Exactly how it does so, however, has not always been made very clear. It must be said that some of the more popular traditional explanations of this nyama are a bit childish and superficial. For example, many legends report that when the Buddha gained enlightenment, and also when he died, and indeed on other momentous occasions, the earth shook and trembled in six different ways, and this, according to some commentators, was due to the operation of Dharma Niyama. In fact, we do not have to look very far in order to locate a more sensible and helpful interpretation. The obvious key, it seems to me at least, is in the distinction between the two types or modes of conditionality. The first four niyamas, including karma niyama, are all types of conditionality in the cyclical sense, in the sense of action and reaction between pairs of opposites. But dharma niyama corresponds to the spiral type of conditionality. As such, it constitutes the sum total of the spiritual laws which govern progress through the stages of the Buddhist path. Thus, karma is not the law of conditionality in general, but only that law as operating on a certain level, the ethical level, the plane of moral responsibility. This means we cannot assume that what befalls us necessarily does so as a result of our past actions, because karma is only one of the five levels of conditionality. What happens to us may be a result of physical, biological, psychological, ethical, or spiritual factors. In all likelihood, it will involve a complex combination of factors, bringing several of the niyamas into play. But how does karma actually work? If there is no judge handing out sentences, what does happen? The Abhidharma, that most precise school of Buddhist philosophy, gives us a very clear picture of karma, classifying it from seven different points of view. These are ethical status, door, what that means will be explained when we get to it, appropriateness of resultant experiences, time of taking effect, relative priority of taking effect, function, and the plane on which the karma matures. Let's look at these seven ways of classifying karma one by one. Firstly, how is karma classified according to ethical status? The main point to be grasped here is that the ethical status of a willed action is determined by the state of consciousness in which it is performed. This is absolutely axiomatic for Buddhism. This state of consciousness can be what Buddhists call skillful, or it can be what is called unskillful. And this terminology is significant because it emphasizes that the practice of Buddhist ethics is a matter of intelligence as well as benevolence. Our unskillful mental states are those dominated by craving, neurotic desire, by aversion, hatred, resentment, and by ignorance. We are not punished for them, they simply make us miserable, inasmuch as unskillful states of mind involve a contraction of our being and consciousness, which we experience as misery. Skillful mental states, by contrast, are characterized by contentment, love, understanding, and clarity of mind. And again, there are no prizes handed out to reward us for these skillful actions, whether of body, speech, or mind, result by themselves in a sense of expanded being and consciousness, which we experience as happiness. In a sense, skillful action is happiness. So Buddhist ethics are psychologically based. Action is skillful or unskillful not because it conforms with an external set of rules, but because it accords with a certain state of being. There are rules. Well, they are usually termed precepts. They are rules only in the sense of being rough and ready guides to indicate the way you might normally behave if you were in a certain state of being. The rules are not ends in themselves. They are not imposed by the religious group. They are simply there to be of use towards a specific end, which is enlightenment. The Buddha, moreover, distinguished between natural morality, Pali Pakati Sila, and conventional morality, Panati Sila. Natural morality is universal and based on the facts of human psychology, while conventional morality varies from place to place and is based on custom and opinion. And it is only natural morality which comes under the operation of the law of karma. Some schools of Buddhism are very much concerned to safeguard this psychological and spiritual basis of Buddhist ethics. In order to counter the danger of ethical formalism, the belief that you are good just because you are following the rule book, Zen and the Tantric schools insist on drawing out a surprising, even shocking, implication of the Buddhist approach to morality. They go so far as to maintain that in principle, the enlightened man or woman is quite capable of committing apparently unethical actions. It is the state of consciousness that counts, they say, not the action itself, because it is the state of consciousness that determines the ethical value and therefore the karmic effect of the action, not the other way around. The way these Tantric and Zen schools look at it, such is our propensity to grasp at the easy answers provided by ethical formalism, that we have to be positively scandalized into seeing that Buddhist ethics operate on a different basis from conventional morality. So they come up with some bizarre stories, of which one of the most extreme examples is the following from Tibet. Once upon a time, so this tale begins, there was an ancient and holy hermit who lived all by himself in a mountain cave. And, as this was Tibet, we should probably imagine it as being just above the snow line, thus bitterly cold. So he lived like Milarepa, the famed poet and ascetic, except that he did not live just on nettles, which was Milarepa's staple diet. Though he was very strict and austere, he didn't live on nettles, because just a few miles away there lived an old woman who used to supply him with meals every day, so that he could get on with his meditation without having to bother about food. Every day she used to approach the mouth of the cave with great faith and devotion and set the food down in front of the old hermit. He would eat it silently and give her a blessing. Then she would silently take away the empty dish and go back home while he returned to his meditation. This old lady had a daughter who was also devoted to the old ascetic, and sometimes she sent the girl to give the hermit his meal instead of going herself. One day the daughter went up, as she often did, and placed the food in front of the hermit. But this time, to her great surprise, instead of eating it quietly as usual, the hermit leapt up and tried to rape her. Considerably surprised and even more considerably annoyed, she resisted his assault stoutly. As she was a hefty country wench, and the old hermit was feeble and weak, she had no trouble in beating him off and running home unscathed. "Mother," she cried, as soon as she had her breath back, "what do you think? That old man we've been thinking all this while is so holy. What do you think he tried to do? And she told her mother all about it. Her mother was certainly outraged, but for quite an unexpected reason. You foolish girl, she scolded, you wicked girl, have you no faith? A holy man like that does not try to rape someone for fun. There must have been some important meaning to it. Don't you understand? Go back at once, apologize, and say, here I am, please do as you wish. So the girl went back and found the hermit sitting in front of his cave. She bowed in front of him and said, I am very sorry I was so foolish a little while ago. Here I am at your service. But the hermit said, you're too late. She said, what do you mean? Too late for what? And he said again, too late. What a pity. Too late. The girl was very puzzled and asked again, too late for what? So the old hermit said, well, since after all you were involved, or very nearly involved, I will tell you what was going on. You know, just around the hill, there's a big, wealthy monastery. Well, the abbot there was a very wicked man. He wasn't a good monk at all. He didn't care about the Dharma. He never studied anything, and he was very greedy for money and food and possessions. Now, the fact is, the abbot died just a few hours ago, and as I was meditating, I saw his spirit hovering in the air. It was in a terrible condition, so sad and miserable, and I could see that it was gravitating towards a lower birth, a really unpleasant future life. There were no other people around, but at that moment you turned up. Out of compassion, I wanted to give that unhappy spirit one more chance. I thought, if I move fast, perhaps I can help him at least to be reborn as a human being. But unfortunately, you ran away. And do you know what happened? In that field over there, just after you left, two donkeys copulated, and so, yes, we are too late. The Tibetans tell this story whenever they get the chance. It's one of their favourites, and it does illustrate the point. It is indeed the sheer unlikelihood of a compassionate act of rape that makes the point. Whatever the ethical rule, however straightforward it may seem, though it may cover many, many instances, it can never be regarded as absolute. The state of consciousness in which an action is performed is what determines its ethical value. Of course, this teaching, though it is crucial, can easily be misunderstood. It is only too easy to make it mean, if it feels good, do it. But this is a complete distortion of the Buddhist ethic. After all, quite a lot of people feel good, even when they are doing something which is unskillful in every sense. It's not a question of following your instincts or feelings willy-nilly, but of trying to achieve the most positive mental state possible and acting from that. The ethical rules or precepts are always there to provide a guide to the kind of action that will support positive mental states, even when your mental states are less than positive. But the ideal, the aim of Buddhist ethics, is to succeed in acting from a positive, skillful mental state, one of contentment, love, compassion, peace, tranquility, joy, wisdom, awareness, and clarity of understanding. So much for the classification of karma according to ethical status. Next, the classification of karma according to door. This picturesque expression refers to the door through which, as it were, the karma is performed. Traditionally, Buddhism divides the human being into three aspects, body, speech and mind. These are the doors. For it is not only physical actions and actions in the form of speech that have karmic consequences. Mental actions, that is, thoughts and feelings, do too. In fact, any action of whatever kind will only have a karmic effect if it is intentional. If you didn't mean to do something, or if what you say is misinterpreted, that action does not produce effects under the law of karma. Here, Buddhism differs from Jainism. Jainism holds that if, for example, you take life by accident, even if you've taken all possible precautions against doing so, that action still has karmic consequences which will cause you to suffer in the future. In other words, the Jain system of ethics is based on rules, very complicated rules, whereas the Buddhist system is based on psychology. Thirdly, karma can be classified according to the appropriateness of resultant experiences. Putting it crudely, and indeed un-Buddhistically, this is saying that karma works by making the punishment fit the crime. For example, if you adopt an attitude of reverence for life, if you guard and protect living beings, you will be reborn in a state of happiness in which you will enjoy long life. If, on the contrary, you deliberately take life, you will be reborn in a state of suffering and your life will be short. In the same way, if you practice generosity, you will be reborn in comfortable circumstances. But if you are mean, you will be reborn poor and destitute. If you show respect and honour for others, you will be reborn in a high social position. But if you look down on others and treat them with contempt, you will be reborn at the bottom of the social scale. Sometimes this principle is applied in a way that may seem to us in the West a bit ludicrous. For instance, one of the texts says that if you slander others, if you gossip unkindly about other people, you will be reborn suffering from halitosis. There's also the story of the Arahat who was born a dwarf. Apparently, the Buddha had a disciple who was a dwarf. He was enlightened. His Dharma knowledge was immense. He was a wonderful preacher, but he was a dwarf and a hunchback too. The story goes that one day the Buddha's disciples began to discuss the case of this dwarf. He must have done many good things in previous lives to have been reborn as a disciple of the Buddha. But what could he possibly have done to be born a dwarf? To satisfy their curiosity, the Buddha is supposed to have told the following story. Thousands and thousands of years ago, in a certain remote world period, there was a Buddha, in fact, a Pracheka Buddha, that is, a private Buddha, one who gains enlightenment but does not teach. When this Buddha died, the whole community decided to erect a magnificent monument to commemorate his life. As they discussed the project, some people said the monument should be 20 feet high, while others thought it should be at least 40 feet high. And as this discussion was going on, the person who was to be reborn as a dwarf came along and said, "What on earth does it matter? Surely a small monument will do." It was as a result of that very bad karma that he was reborn as a dwarf. I remember this story being told very solemnly in a Burmese Buddhist magazine. At the time, some Buddhists, I was one of them, were suggesting that instead of spending all their spare cash gilding monuments, the Burmese might usefully devote some of it to printing books on Buddhism. They trotted out this apocryphal story to show the terrible karmic consequences we were apparently creating for ourselves by suggesting such a thing. And it just shows the rather silly way in which this principle has sometimes been applied. Despite such slightly tendentious applications, however, the principle holds good. The principle is, in fact, quite clear. We could put it another way. Whatever we do to other people, we are in the long run also doing to ourselves. This is not just Buddhist theology, it's good, sound psychology. We could even put it the other way round and say that whatever we do to ourselves, we are, in the long run, doing to other people. The fourth way of classifying karma is according to time of taking effect. In this sense, there are three kinds of karma: those which take effect in the present life, that is, the results accrue during the life in which the action was committed; those which take effect in a subsequent life; and those which do not take effect at all. This third category may come as a surprise. In some popular expositions, the idea is put forward that karma is an iron law from which nothing escapes. It is suggested that even if you did a very small action, good or bad, millions of years ago, in some remote existence, it will catch up with you in the end. And this is clearly an idea which appeals strongly to some people, that you never escape, that you will ultimately have to pay for everything you've done. It is not, however, the Buddhist teaching. According to Buddhism, some karmas, whether skillful or unskillful, are just cancelled out in the course of time. They may be counterbalanced by opposite karmas or simply lose their force. Lacking an opportunity for expression, they may just fade away. So there's no iron law of karma. Some karmas do not produce any effect at all. The fifth way of ordering karma, karma according to relative priority of taking effect, brings us to the question of rebirth. Rebirth is the result of karma, but karma is of many different kinds. When you have died and are about to be reborn, there are all sorts of karmas in the background, crowding in, so to speak, waiting to produce their effect. So the question addressed here is this: in what order of priority do they influence the nature of your rebirth? According to this mode of classification, karmas basically line up in four groups of relative priority. Firstly, under the heading of weighty karma, are gathered those karmas which embody conscious volitions, whether skillful or unskillful, which are so strong that they modify and affect your whole character. The example usually given of an unskillful weighty karma is that of the deliberate taking of life, murder, especially if the victim is spiritually advanced. An important skillful weighty karma, on the other hand, is meditation. But you have to be clear what this means here, because the word seems to be more often used, even among Buddhists, in the sense of trying to meditate, rather than in the sense of actually experiencing higher states of consciousness. As a skillful weighty karma, meditation is not just a dreamy, passive sort of wool gathering. It's an action which modifies your whole being, your whole character, your whole consciousness, both here and now and in the future. When you have been meditating, you shouldn't end up in a sweet, gentle, slightly abstracted state of mind. If you do, you may have been having a pleasant little reverie, but it will not have been meditation. Meditation is something much more dynamic, more challenging, even more shattering. After it, you should feel full of power and energy in life. So weighty karma, whether skillful or unskillful, exerts a tremendous influence. Second in the scale of influence over one's rebirth is death-proximate karma. This means a sort of mental image which appears at the time of death, usually one which connects in some way with your activities and interests in life. The example commonly given in this regard is that of the butcher who, we are told, is very likely to see visions of slaughter at the time of his or her death. So he or she may well see an animal being butchered, or hear its cries, and see blood and meat cleavers. Obviously, his or her mental state will not then be a very happy one. A painter, by contrast, might see beautiful forms, colours and shapes, while a musician might hear music. Whatever you experience, however, does not necessarily have to be connected with your previous life. The image you see at this time may alternatively be connected with the place of your future rebirth. If you see a beautiful lotus flower, white or pink or golden, This is said to indicate rebirth on a higher plane of consciousness, a heaven realm. If, on the other hand, you see flames, this of course indicates rebirth in another place. The third category of karma which has an effect at this time is habitual karma, which is any action which one has repeated a number of times during one's life. A very great part of one's life is probably made up of habitual karmas, things we do over and over again, often without realizing the effect they are having on us. The action itself may not amount to very much. It may not take up much time. But if we do it every day, perhaps several times a day, it has its effect, like drops of water wearing away a stone. All the time we are creating karma, either forging a sort of chain which binds us, or planting seeds of future growth. And it need not necessarily be repeated physical action, even an action which we do only once, but on which we continually reflect, mentally reenacting it again and again. This also counts as habitual karma. There's no need to offer examples of this, I'm sure. The fourth and last karma, distinguished according to relative priority of taking effect, is called residual karma, which constitutes any willed action not included under the other three headings. The Abhidharma is nothing if not tidy. So when we are between death and rebirth, between one life and another, hovering on the brink, these karmas come into effect and determine the nature of our rebirth in this order. According to the Abhidharma, the weighty karmas take effect first. If you have, to your debit or credit, a weighty karma, it is this that will decide initially the kind of rebirth you will have. One can now begin to appreciate the importance of meditation from the karmic point of view. If you have meditated much during your life, if you have dwelt in a higher state of consciousness consistently, or even from time to time, or even once, if you have really penetrated to some higher level of being during your lifetime, even just for a few minutes, it is that factor which will initially determine the nature of your future rebirth. Other factors will take effect afterwards. If, however, you have drawn no weighty karma, either skillful or unskillful, in your previous life, your rebirth is determined by the death proximate karma. In the absence of death proximate karma, it is determined by habitual karma. And in the absence even of habitual karma, this would be very unusual, it is determined by residual karma. At least some Abhidharma authorities give this order of priority, while others say that habitual karma takes precedence over death proximate karma. But despite this difference of opinion, the general picture is clear. Karmas can overlap these categories, of course. A particular karma could function in all of these ways. For instance, if you have meditated during your lifetime, that's a weighty karma. If at the time of your death you think of that meditation experience, it becomes a death proximate karma. And if during your lifetime you've meditated many, many times, it will also be a habitual karma. If meditation is your weighty karma, your death proximate karma, and also your habitual karma, then obviously meditation is going to be very much the determining factor when it comes to your next rebirth. You are likely, according to Buddhism, to be reborn in a higher state of consciousness, even in a higher world than before. You will be virtually a born yogi, living in a world fit for yogis to live in. The sixth classification of karma after according to relative priority of taking effect is according to function. This refers to a fourfold disposition of karmas: reproductive, supportive, counteractive, and destructive. Reproductive karmas are those which are directly responsible for the production of a new life after death. So this category refers to the way we create tendencies, which will result in our being reborn, the way we indulge our craving, aversion, and ignorance. Supportive karma refers to the way we set up and reinforce those tendencies. Counteractive karma refers to the process by which the effects of our actions can be offset, countered, or cancelled by other actions. Thus, weighty positive karma, like meditative concentration, would be counteractive karma inasmuch as it cancelled out weighty negative karma, like gross breaches of the ethical precepts. Finally, destructive karma is any experience of insight into reality sustained deeply enough to destroy negative karma at the root. There is a traditional simile which illustrates this classification. Reproductive karma is compared to a seed planted in a field, the new life, as it were, planted in the mother's womb. Supportive karma is like the rain and manure which nourish the seed and help it to grow into a plant. Counteractive karma is like a hailstorm which falls upon the growing crops and damages them. And destructive karma is like fire which burns up the whole field so that the crop perishes. So from the point of view of function, karmas are of these four kinds. The seventh and last classification of karma is according to the plane on which the karma matures. This is very important, and again it's closely connected with the whole question of rebirth. In the Buddhist world picture, the universe is conceived in terms of space-time, and also in terms of what we might call depth, or the spiritual dimension. Space-time represents the objective material aspect of conditioned existence, whereas the spiritual dimension represents its mental subjective aspect. The first of these aspects we usually refer to as the world, or sphere, or plane in which we exist, while the second we refer to as our state of mind, or experience of that existence. In the microcosm of the individual human being, these two poles or dimensions are represented by body and mind. Body being the human entity in terms of space and time, and mind being the same human entity in terms of depth or spiritual dimension. All this is illustrated by the Tibetan Book of the Dead, which, among other things, tries to answer the question, what happens when we die? It describes how the senses gradually fail. You no longer hear or see or smell or taste or feel. Eventually, consciousness detaches itself from the body. The body loses its heat. Then, even the subtle psychic link, which exists between the body and its non-material aspects, snaps. At that point, you are really and truly dead. And then, according to the Buddhist teaching, exemplified in great detail by the Tibetan Book of the Dead, in that first instant after you are completely dead, you find yourself face to face with reality itself. It is as though throughout your life the body, the senses, the lower mind sheltered you from reality all the time, shutting it out, or at least filtering it so that you only experienced a very little of it at a time. But after death, when the body is no longer there, when the lower mind is no longer there, or is at least suspended, reality dawns and flashes upon you for one dreadful instant. I say dreadful because most people cannot bear it. They shrink back in terror. Humankind, as T.S. Eliot puts it, cannot bear very much reality. When the human consciousness finds itself face to face with reality, this can be a terrifying experience from which the mind flees, retreating to lower and ever lower levels, until at last it finds itself on a level where it feels at home. On that level it grasps a body, and in that body it is then, as we say, reborn. Of course, we should not be misled by words. We speak of the consciousness coming and going. We even speak of it passing from one body to another. But there is no real coming and going of consciousness. It does not occupy space in a literal sense. It cannot enter a body. Mind and body are like the two ends of a stick. You grasp one and the other automatically follows. So these are the seven classifications of karma, and together with the five niyamas, they give a comprehensive picture of the nature of karma. Karma is one's own deliberately willed action and the results which follow from that, as well as the law by virtue of which the one follows upon the other. It is not fate, it is not destiny. Neither is it the law of cause and effect in general. As the teaching of the five niyamas makes clear, karma is just one kind of conditionality, albeit a very important one, among four others. It is therefore wrong to say that whatever happens is the result of karma. Some people imagine that if, when something happens to them, they say, "Ah, well, that must be my karma. They are being very pious, very Buddhist." But this is not, in fact, the Buddhist teaching. Buddhism teaches that whatever happens, happens as a result of conditions, but that not all those conditions are karma. Karma is only one among the five kinds of conditionality at work in the universe. Events may be the result of karma, or they may not. How we find out is another question altogether. A difficulty that crops up sometimes is the relationship between rebirth and the Anatman teaching, the teaching that there is no self or no soul. One might think, if there is no soul which passes from one life, one body, to another, how does rebirth take place? It might seem that you've got to sacrifice either the Anatman doctrine or the teaching of rebirth. You can't have both. But this is an artificial difficulty. Anatman does not, as we've said in our opening chapter, actually mean no soul in the sense of no psychic life at all. It means no unchanging soul, no unchanging self. When it comes to rebirth, there is a substratum of mental activity that flows from life to life, now linked with this body, now with that. It is the linking of a fresh body with this stream of mental activity which constitutes what we call rebirth. So there is no contradiction. You can have Anatman and rebirth side by side. By this stage in a discussion of karma, one can sometimes find oneself thinking, "It's all very well, it hangs together beautifully, it all sounds very plausible, but is it true? How can we know? What is the proof?" The average Western mind wants hard evidence, and this is slowly but assiduously being gathered. Teams of researchers are systematically investigating the cases of people who claim to be able to remember their previous lives. Records are gathered and published of ordinary people, not saints or sages or meditators, who claim, for no apparent reason, to remember a previous life. They usually go into all the details, too: their name, where they lived, what they did, what illness they died of, and so on. And it seems that these details are found to tally with what is still known about the lives, ordinary humdrum lives for the most part, that they claim to recall. The scientists tend to be particularly interested in the many cases of curious recollections of this kind on the part of children. The possibility of coincidence or fraud or imagination has been ruled out completely in many cases, and researchers seem inclined to admit that a hypothesis of rebirth or reincarnation would provide the simplest explanation for the facts. As more and more evidence of this sort comes to light, I have no doubt that it will eventually convince all open-minded people of the truth of the teaching of karma and rebirth. Some people point to further evidence for karma and rebirth in the existence of child prodigies. When you get a child like the young Mozart, who could play, sing, and compose at a very tender age, it is hard to believe that this degree of knowledge and proficiency could possibly have been acquired entirely in the present life. It must, so it is argued, have been carried over from a previous life. But this brings up the whole question of heredity. There is no general agreement as to what can and cannot be inherited in the genes. The issue is complicated, besides, by all sorts of factors, both personal and cultural, so that particular line of argument is hardly as convincing as the evidence of recollection. The idea of karma and rebirth certainly resolves many more questions and problems than it creates, but this is not to say that there are no loose ends in the teaching. In my opinion, the traditional doctrine needs a thorough reformulation, taking account of various matters that have not so far apparently been considered in the East. For instance, there is the whole question of the relation between karma and rebirth and time, and between karma and rebirth and the individual consciousness. Karma and rebirth operate within time. So what is time? Karma and rebirth pertain to the individual consciousness. So what is that? There is also the knotty question of population explosion. Where have all the people come from? Has there been a sort of fission of souls? Or have they come from other realms or other worlds? Some Eastern Buddhists would say loftily, "Of course they've come from other realms and worlds. Everybody knows that." But is this the only possible solution? These and similar questions will have to be given full consideration in a new formulation of the traditional teaching, Buddhist teaching, of karma and rebirth. And this reformulation will perhaps be one of the works of Western Buddhism. In the end, we have to admit that there will be, for some time perhaps, a certain amount of resistance from many quarters in the West to the idea of karma and rebirth. As we have seen, it cuts across a lot of our Western assumptions about some of our deepest concerns. So an important question for a lot of people is this: do you have to believe in karma and rebirth to be a Buddhist? The simple answer is yes. But an answer which might be more illuminating is no, but on one condition. You need not believe in karma and rebirth, provided that you are willing to go all out for full enlightenment in this life. This is certainly true and might satisfy some people. But it also shows at once how difficult it might be to practice Buddhism seriously without installing karma and rebirth as part of one's mental furniture, so to speak. The teaching of karma and rebirth does provide an answer, perhaps the answer, to certain questions. It helps to resolve the mystery of death, which is also the mystery of life. And very few people can follow the path to enlightenment without bothering at least sometimes about such questions. A few may be happy to get on with their meditation and not worry about philosophy, but most people require some answers. They really want to know, and it is only within the framework of this sort of knowledge that they can practice at all. They need to have some general philosophical framework, however rudimentary or sketchy, within which to follow the path. The teaching of karma and rebirth does give, at least in part, such a framework. If we do not accept karma and rebirth as a solution, we are going to have to find another one, and that, I think, will not be easy. I personally believe that the teaching of karma and rebirth is the most satisfactory answer to many of the questions raised by the fact of death and the nature of human life and existence. It is not only true, it gives meaning and purpose to life. It makes it clear that human beings are pilgrims through a succession of lives, and that by changing our consciousness, something which is, according to Buddhism, very much within our power, we can determine our own destiny, not only in this life, but in future lives as well. This means that no real effort is ever wasted. The good is conserved from life to life. There is no question of reward, and there is no question of punishment. By performing a consciously willed action, we modify our own consciousness, both here and now and for the future. And that is surely reward or punishment enough. I would say personally that the teaching of karma and rebirth is an integral part of Buddhism, and that for most people, it would be difficult to be a Buddhist without accepting it, at least in principle. Traditionally, the truth of the teaching of karma and rebirth is said to become clear in the light of higher states of consciousness, and especially in that highest of all states of consciousness, so high that it is not really to be called a state of consciousness as such, the enlightenment of a Buddha. In the East, it is held that there are some truths, call them spiritual truths if you like, that cannot be perceived by the ordinary rational mind. This is, of course, a point of view that we in the West usually find completely unacceptable. We tend to take it for granted that anything that can be understood or seen can be understood and seen by our ordinary, conscious, everyday mind. This mind, we assume, is capable of understanding anything that can be understood at all. But Eastern tradition, especially Indian tradition, says that there are some truths, some laws or principles, if you like, which cannot be understood by the ordinary human mind. If you want to understand them, you have to raise your level of consciousness, in the same way that if you want to see a long way, you have to climb a mountain. Buddhists take the view that if you climb the mountainside of your own consciousness, you will see, spread out before you as it were, spiritual truths which in your ordinary state of consciousness you could not have perceived. According to Indian tradition, the teaching of karma and rebirth is one of these truths. Our ordinary rational consciousness cannot apprehend it. We may be able to understand it when it is explained to us, but we cannot really see the truth of it directly. Karma and rebirth, in all their details, all their workings, all their ramifications, are perceived only by a Buddha. This means that the hard facts, as it were, are not really available to us. However, in the course of the thousands of years of the development of Buddhism, all the Buddhist sages and yogis have testified to the truth of karma and rebirth. There has never been a school of Buddhism or a prominent Buddhist teacher who has questioned it, which is interesting. If the teaching of karma and rebirth had been just a doctrine, a philosophical idea, a speculation, surely someone in the Buddhist world at some time would have denied it or at least doubted it. Buddhists have complete freedom of thought. There is no ecclesiastical power to coerce them into orthodoxy. So Buddhist history is full of the questioning of doctrine. Why, then, has the teaching of karma and rebirth never apparently been questioned? I suggest that this is because karma and rebirth is not a matter of speculation and philosophy, but one of experience and perception. As the great yogis and meditators increased in spiritual understanding and insight, they would have seen more and more clearly the truth of this teaching. They may not have perceived it as fully as the Buddha did, but they saw enough of it to be convinced of its truth. So in the East, the evidence of the superconscious perception of the Buddha and other enlightened teachers is considered conclusive proof of the truth of karma and rebirth. For practicing Buddhists, at least, this should provide sufficient basis for their faith until they can perceive the truth of karma and rebirth directly for themselves. Karma and rebirth is a complex subject, but some understanding of the teaching is essential to an understanding of who the Buddha is. The Buddha's primary insight into the nature of reality, the realization of which made him who he was, arose out of his direct perception of the workings of karma and rebirth. On the night of his enlightenment, as he was seated beneath the Bodhi tree, the Buddha saw, in a flash of illumination, the whole series of his previous existences, tens of thousands of previous lives. Not only that, he could see, stretching back into the past, the previous lives of other beings, and on that night, whenever he wished, subsequently, he could see their future existences too. The Buddha taught the doctrine of karma and rebirth not as a philosophical teaching, something he'd worked out logically, but as something he had experienced, something he had seen. This faculty, this ability to see previous lives, one's own and other people's, is technically known as Purvanivasa Smriti, literally, recollection of previous abodes. It is reckoned as one of the five or six abhijnas, the super-knowledges, and we are told that it can be cultivated on the basis of the practice of meditation by anybody who cares to make the effort.